Hi, Golf Badgers. Welcome back. It is another wet Thursday night here in the world. It has been dry for a week now, though. And are you dry where you are, Sam, which is basically less than a mile down the road?
No, the microclimate doesn't get that specific, really, Bledge, from one end of the golf course to another. But it was dry. It was lovely earlier, actually. It was blue skies and sunny and a bit warmer. But no, back to normal service, and it's raining again. Raining again now.
Big gains in the golf course the last week, and I hope all our Parkland friends have kind of had the same. I was speaking to John McLaughlin earlier, and he was saying that he's kind of getting most of his bunkers back in play. Now we had another 60 bunkers back in play this week, and the greens are a lot firmer. And yeah, it's actually, there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. But saying that, we had a frost this morning, and it's peeing down again. So, but on the subject of John McLaughlin, I've got a tweet to read out here that I seen earlier that was quite interesting. And in true John fashion, I will read it out in his accent. Should I?
You'll try. Now, well, you can try and read out in his accent. You've never got one accent.
I'll bring John in. John, come into the office.
Okay. All right, Ledge.
Hi, John.
If you're a greenkeeper and have an upcoming interview and need any help, send me a DM, as I'd be happy to help in any way I can. Hashtag pay it forward.
Right, on behalf of the podcast, can I just absolutely apologise to John Mack there, who sounds nothing at all like Pledge's shameful impression.
So this is a actually really nice request from John to do this, because John does a lot for our industry, FTMI. He's awesome at all that kind of stuff, and he genuinely, he's a busy man, but he's putting a genuine cry out there, a call out there for anyone that wants any help with their interview techniques or anything, CV cover letters, to DM him. So,
well, Ledge, why don't we just take a step back, and we've grown this podcast quite significantly for some unknown reason, especially over the last
my
few
impressions.
Months. So, in spite of Ledge's impressions, so why don't we just take a moment to quickly recap, introduce yourself, myself, and then we can say who John Mack is for anyone who, for some reason, might not have come across him and wouldn't recognize him if they had spoken to him previously, and make sure everyone is well and truly up to speed. So, Ledge, who are you? What's your background? And make sure everyone knows.
Can we introduce each other? I quite like to introduce you, Sam.
Okay.
Right.
Shall I try you then?
I'll go first. Okay. Right. So I'm Sam Cooper, my friend is Sam Cooper. Sam is he's actually a youngster. He's a young guy, very attractive guy, very, very clever guy, very, very good golfer, great ball striker, low penetrating ball flight, but works for CDP. Clayton DeVries and Pont, which should be CDPC or CCDP, as an architect, and traveling the country and giving architectural advice to all who wish. Sam is also an author of a little,
and often those who don't.
Yeah, and has traveled. During lockdown, has travelled the length, the circumference of the country, playing every Lynx golf course. Yes, apart from Ardfin, which we're working on.
Well, every Lynx golf course, yes. Well, thank you, Bledge. That was very nice. I'm not sure whether it clears up any of the confusion as first-time listeners, but that's a very kind.
I've not actually finished. And Sam is working at Wallasey Golf Club, which is, of course, very close to us, with our dear friend John McLaughlin, who we'll get on to in a second.
Which is where the John connection comes from. Well, should I give my little summary of you then, Bledge? It won't be anywhere near as kind as yours.
That's fine. No one ever says kind things about me.
No, I suppose it could be. So Bledge, you made your name, I'd say, to most at Royal Cinque Port, where you were, what, 8 years did you do as the course manager?
Nine.
There? Nine. Oh, sorry.
Seven. Seven as okay. course manager. And
so I was closer.
Two as deputy.
There you go. Meet in the middle. So so down there, and that's where I think we first crossed paths. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed as someone when I was traveling around the country and sort of really getting into the industry properly is your style of communication and how much you actually put out there on Twitter in particular and the blogs that you'd write about what you were doing to the golf course. But more than just saying what you were doing to the golf course, I think you spent a lot of time saying why you were doing what you were doing to the course. And for me, that was something that is often overlooked and something that, as we look to do this podcast, was the thing that we've really, really tried hard to make a key theme of really, really digging down and trying to understand what goes into a course from a design and from a greenkeeping perspective, why we try and achieve what we try and achieve. But whilst it was a deal that you really became well known, I think you spent a number of years before that. You were over in Sweden, weren't you? And mm-hmm. You were at G West as part of the growing there, which was a really interesting story that we probably should come back to in a future episode.
We should probably do a whole podcast on that, actually.
Yeah, I think we should probably should talk about that interesting story. King's Barnes, you spent a bit of time at King's Barnes and at Gullen as well.
Yep.
And of course from Dumfries and Galloway originally, and that is again an area close to both of our hearts because we both have a connection with Southern Ness Golf Club down there. But the person or where you're at the moment, of course, is course manager at Royal Liverpool. And at one point you were the man in the spotlight and now you are yesterday's man stepping out of the spotlight of the Open Championship rota. But we're very lucky that means that we get more time, more insight from you for this podcast. So I think fair covered both of us there, Bledgy. And
yep.
And then John has still not been on this podcast, despite what it sounds like at times. And
he was here just a minute ago, but he had to go.
And of course, there's our great friend down the road at Wallasey. And we really need to try and remedy that and persuade him in properly, Bledge. But why don't you just offer a little bit more background then as to why John's tweet is so valuable? Because from my understanding, as someone not particularly in the greenkeeping industry per se, but John really does seem to have forged a reputation as a great mentor and really giving to FTMI and a lot of the things to help develop future course managers and all the rest of it.
Well, one of the most important things in this industry, and in fact many industries, many jobs, walks of life, is the skill set you need to progress yourself. I mean, it's not always about knowing your soil science or your chemistry or how to put a valve box together. To be able to progress to course manager or deputy, you need to have the skill set, interview techniques, good cover letter writing, good CV writing, how to prepare yourself for all this stuff in order to get a job. And they don't teach you that at college. And there's a bit of it continue to learn. But where I learned the skill set was FTMI. And not everyone get on that. You know, it's you've got to apply to get on it and only a certain amount of people are picked to get on it. And that's, again, to get on that, you have to have the skill set, ironically, of putting yourself forward in kind of in letter form or form. And myself and John were mentors in that. After being students, we were in the first class together. And this is John's way of giving back now. And I've done it myself countless amounts of times. I mean, I've had quite actually, and honestly, monthly, emails or messages asking for guys for if I can look through their cover letter or their CV, or we can talk about their interview techniques. And I love doing that, you know, because I love to help people step their way up the ladder, and John's exactly the same. So John had put this request out today for anyone that is after some help. And it's, let me just tell you what his Twitter handle is. It's it's at John Mac, JOHN Mac, MAC 150. So yeah, watch this. Hopefully the inbox will be flooding you.
Very important, especially, I think it's always a recurring theme, more people coming through the industry and promoting and just recruiting to the industry, because purely as a golfer, if we don't have people doing your job, Bledge, and all of the variations of it, then we don't have a sport that we get to play. We don't have golf courses. They don't just exist without you guys. So I think that's very, very important. It's great that you all value sort of giving back and developing the next generation so much.
I think the biggest part of that is there's so many amazing greenkeepers out there that don't have that skill set, and it's a shame and they're not being seen for that reason. And it's only just to get them the interview, through the interview, you know. And I've had brilliant guys that have had CVs over 5-6 pages, you know, and just absolute waffle. And I've had guys in there that have not been able to tell me anything about the golf club or any of the history, that I haven't even set foot in the place yet. I know that they've had great recommendations from other greenkeepers, you know, and testimonials or references, sorry. And you think this is such a shame, you know, and I think it's such a big skill set to learn. So it's something that a lot of people need to get better at. And yeah, John's there to help. Sorry.
Brilliant.
For buttoning.
No, it's very important point. But whilst we have talked there about greenkeeping industry and all the rest of it, we actually wanted to try something a little different today with this podcast, which is catering to a slightly different audience, I would say. So, you know, if you are a course manager, if you are a greenkeeper and have been for many years, then hopefully, to be honest, you'll find everything that we say from here on in, probably in typical fashion, to be very, very dull and not very insightful at all. Because not only do we have a great deal of course managers and greenkeepers who listen to the podcast, and a lot of people indeed who work throughout the golfing industry, especially here in Britain, but we seem to have really brought along a bunch of people who, they don't work. They're just golfers who love golf, love their course, but because whatever reason, just a little bit more interested in what actually goes into maintaining, running, setting up a golf course, they've started listening along and sort of questioning that a little bit more and reading a little more and just immersing themselves in the subject matter a bit. And I would say that Ledger and I are guilty on occasion of just sort of having an assumed level of knowledge, and we might get a bit jargony and you know, just gloss over things that, you know, certainly experienced course managers like yourself might, you know, take for absolute granted and take as read. But I hope that we can occasionally do an episode like this where, if you have something that we've talked about or something that we've mentioned that you didn't quite understand, and why would you? You know, it's not the subject matter by definition, but we might have just said something and gone, oh, I wonder why they do that. I wonder why they cut at such and such a height. I wonder why they cut the rough down. I wonder why they do these things. I'm gonna ask in. Please do, you know, send an email into hello@golfbadgers.com. And remember that Bledge and I genuinely, with this, there are no stupid questions. It is just anything at all that it could be the most basic thing in the world. It could be something that you just, you're thinking about saying in a different way. We would love, love, love for anyone to send something in. And if it helps get just a few more people more interested, asking the right questions, maybe even considering something like this as a potential career for themselves, then that's a little win, really, isn't it, Bledge, for golf, for the greenkeeping industry in general. Mm-hmm. So that is what we're looking to do in the first of this style of podcast today.
Exactly. I think, definitely. I mean, we've got a load of people that have been in touch that are not necessarily greenkeepers, and this one is kind of aimed a little bit at them. So if this episode is a little bit patronizing or teaches you how to suck eggs, then we apologize, but we need to pretend that everyone is super fan Andy Farrell today, I think.
That'd be there, right. You go.
Was there any questions for Andy Farrell?
No, and Andy hopefully will send him 5 questions next week to compensate.
He's not been cutting his grass, that's why.
Well, that would be the reason. But rather than just bang off a load of random disparate answers, I thought a good way of doing it might be to pick one thing in particular, one sort of question, one kind of theme, and use it to illustrate some of the principles and concepts that, you know, I am the genuine novice in all of this conversation, Bledge. So, you know, the things that I've learned from doing this podcast, you know, I think I'd like to put these things back to you. And the way I'm going to frame the question to start with is, you know, I'm sure many of us watched the Masters last weekend, and I'm sure quite a few before the Masters started saw that brilliant viral clip of Ken on the course. Come on, Ken, different Ken. Ken on the course, rolling a ball off his stimp meter downhill, mm-hmm. and it running, I don't know, 30 odd feet, and then mm-hmm. rolling it uphill and it rolling 3 feet or 5 feet maybe. But you know, it really illustrated the slow but also the speed of those greens. Now we are sort of entering the spring very, very slowly here in Britain, and green speeds, I think, are something that all golfers must ask their course managers and the greenkeepers and greens chairman about every single course. So there is no course that could be immune to a question about green speeds. So the way I'm thinking is, what are the impacts on green speed? And what are the things that, you know, there are superficial answers to the question, like cut the grass shorter, let's say. But I want to really get down, what does that mean? What does it mean to the grass species, to the thing, you know, to all of the other things that perhaps most golfers might not automatically consider? So can you sort of think on that question, Bledge? What are the first, let's say, drivers of green speed beyond cut height as a starting point?
Yeah, I mean, it would be easy to say cut height, wouldn't it? And that's obviously is a factor, but it's certainly not the most important one. You know, there's one of the kind of biggest things that comes to mind to start off with would be moisture. You know, moisture plays a part in quite a few ways, because obviously more moisture, more growth potential, the more the greens are growing. You can, especially in parkland golf courses, poor greens. The grass grows a lot from the start of the day when the greens are cut, 5-6 o'clock in the morning, till when the last person's maybe knocking about for 9 holes at 8 o'clock at night. It could grow a millimetre by that time. A lot of greenkeepers use growth retardants to slow that growth to get more consistent growth. We, in a lot of parkland golf courses, you'll see the kind of white tinge, especially at this time of year that's just about to start. Is the Poanya. Golf courses, parkland golf courses, consist grass species of mostly Poanya, actually, on most, very, very common. I would actually like to see a kind of a survey of the British golf courses to see what the kind of most common grasses are. Now, I bet you Poania would take up a good 70%, maybe
okay,
even more.
Well, you know, as novice diving in there then, so you've mentioned Poania, and I guess that's a bunch of different species, really, is it, that you lump in annual meadow grass together as one kind of category?
Yeah, annual meadow grass in itself, yeah. So there's no kind of subspecies to that, I guess. It forms in different ways. And we're more kind of talking about the efflores on it, the florens, the flower head, the efflores, I think you call that, is it? Efflorescence.
But what would the other kind of cool season, and what do I mean by cool season? You know, what are the, in let's stick to Britain because it's where we're based. Mm-hmm. What are the other kind of grasses that you might see? And, you know, let's say that all of them were cut at the same height. What impact do the different grass species that you might expect to get? What do they, or you know, how do they influence green speeds?
That's a great question. It's probably the easiest way to kind of explain it, actually. I mean, if we take a 5 mil base cutting height, for example, on Poania fescue, bent grass, so brown top bent grass, creeping bent grass, and rye grass, you know, going from the slowest, really, I mean, you would find your rye grass is really fat leaf blade, shiny on one side, dark on the other, and the longer they're left to grow, the kind of fatter they get. I mean, 5 mil would be very, very short for a rye grass, but at the same time, you do get rye grass in greens, and it really is a hamper to ball speed. At 5 mil, poa would be really fat and horrible, and the seed head would be very, very large, so 5 mil poa greens would be like treacle. Poa really loves to get cut short. I mean, you have Greg Evans that cuts his poa greens between 2.5-3 mil. In fact, and I would do exactly the same if I had poa greens, I'd be cutting them short, you know. And this is where we use growth retardants and poa and seed head suppressants to make the seed head as small as possible. Products like, we have a chemical called Atraxa, made by BASF, that is, I can't think of the active ingredient now off the top of my head just now, but that shrinks the poa seed head. Starting spraying at this time of year when the flowers start to come out in the tree and 21 days apart, even if you're decreasing that poa seed head by half, it's going to make a big difference, browning it off, burning it off. There used to be a chemical back in the day, Cerone, that would completely get rid of your poa seed heads, and then you're going to get more speed because it's the seed head that's really causing the friction against the ball. If we're moving on to things like creeping bent grass at 5 mil, really does not enjoy that at all. You know, creeping bent, if you're growing a creeping bent green, getting it cut as short as possible, as fast as possible, really, that's how it likes
to be. So creeping bent at 5 mil, that would be the next in sort of the hierarchy of resistance to the ball, effectively. So
yes, I would say, I mean, from rye grass and poa through to creeping bent and bent grass, really, bent grass doesn't really love getting cut as high as 5 mil either, I wouldn't have said, brown top bent. And then, but it doesn't flower. Not at that height. And next after that is fescue, which is such a small leaf surface that actually needs quite a lot of leaf and a lot of length to be able to be at its healthiest and put down roots through photosynthesis and creating sugars for itself, carbohydrates. So by cutting that down, it's basically like if you were to cut my arms and legs off, you know, it needs
leaf. Well, I think
that's...
I think that's the thing that, you know, purely approaching this as conventional golfer who might never have thought about this stuff before. Certainly from my point of view, I remember it's almost like golfers perhaps will think of a green as a putting green in the same way you might think of the bays on a snooker table. You know, it's a surface, it's a contiguous surface, it's green, it's all the same thing, and it's almost like a carpet. And I remember when I sort of started thinking, well, actually they're plants. They are individual plants, or little perhaps, you know, clusters of plants at least. And then you have, again, if we have that spectrum in mind of the fescues at one end, And Bledge, am I right in basically saying from that summary, because they are so slender and because they are so slight, you know, they're very, very small diameter if you were to look at the actual
needles is the probably the best way to explain to a layman.
They can be, they consist at 5 mil in length, and the ball rolls over them and they offer up no resistance or very, very little resistance at all, because they just, you know, the ball just goes trundling along over the top of them, and you can have a very good green speed with 5 mil on fescue. But what would happen, and sorry, at the other end of the spectrum, if you've got 5 mil rye, which is what, woody and chunky and fat, and you roll the ball over that, well, the piece of grass there offers more resistance, so therefore you have a slower green speed. And, you know, that is a big part of the source of the formula. So what would happen if we just took those two as illustrating opposite ends of the spectrum? If you were to cut, let's say, the fescue down to 2.5 mil, and you were to cut the rye or the poa perhaps down to 2.5 mil, what would be the effect over time to both of those different types of grasses?
Super way to put it, Sam. Yeah, really good. It's a very easy outcome that, you know, the fescue would just diminish. It would struggle so much. It would completely get overtaken by the poa, and the poa is an opportunist grass. It would just invade all that space, and in no time at all, it would be a full poa green.
So just out-competed.
I know you were talking about rye there, but let's more talk about poa, because it's probably more chance of having a poa fescue green than rye, really.
Sure.
And it happens a lot. You know, you'll see down at the chipping green here at High Lake, we've got beautiful fescue chipping green surround, but areas where it has got thinner due to the winter, you know, the poa's got in there, you know, it's starting to, and I won't be able to get rid of that until we can burn it off in the summer, because it needs water to survive, because it's such a shallow rooting plant that the fescue can bring the water up from down low with its long roots. So, but yeah, fescue would absolutely hate that height. You know, I'm a believer that you can get fescue, you can keep it all summer 3.75, 4 mil, but you certainly, 3.75 is a kind of stress level on it, you know, for comps or whatever. But you would, yeah, I mean, you keep a fescue green 4 mil all summer, I believe, with the right sensible nutrition and water. But any lower than that, if you're starting to go into threes, forget it. 3.5, struggle.
And that's basically because the surface area of the leaf isn't sufficient to produce the energy it needs to remain healthy, exactly. Effectively, Bledge. So it's more roots, susceptible to disease. Probably what going
invasion.
To root slightly shallower, because it doesn't have the energy to grow in the same way. So let's say, you know, someone's come in and the greens chairman said, right, Bledge, I absolutely want these greens to be rolling at, I don't know, 13 on the stimp meter. And I want you to do that every week, starting from next week. I'm guessing.
Yep. And what is that on my fescue poa green here?
Yeah, yeah, on this green. So the only way you can do it is cut it short.
Well, there are other ways, you know, that this is how we get faster greens. I mean, 13 on fescue is the only way you're getting that, really, is if they're super dry, super rolled, you know, the top's super tight, and you don't have the likes of poas and stuff in there. You would really need your pure sward with that. But there's keeping the sward really
being the mix of the grasses.
The collection of grass. So, I mean, verticutting, grooming, making sure that, because fescue can get matted as well, you know, it's actually a very thatchy grass, and if you're creating a lot of thatch in your fescue through overwatering, or it might not be your own fault, you know, if you've had a wet summer, or too much fertility, not enough traffic, you know, it can get spongy as well, and if it gets that sponge to it, then that's a big speed killer. A big, big speed killer as well. So by managing that well, getting plenty of sand down to dilute the organic matter, and refining it. And I believe at Fescanese Verticut as well, you know, you can't be lazy on it. It's not a maintenance-free grass.
Okay, well, you mentioned thatch there. What's going on there? What's that process? You know, how does the what's going on just below the surface change over time?
So for a layman, then a thatch is a kind of a layer of dead material, organic matter. So it could be old shoots or leaves that could be dropped from clippings, or it just kind of when the plant actually has its life cycle and dies off itself, it deposits itself lower down, and then you have kind of collection of dead material that's quite difficult to for water to kind of push through it. It holds water. And because of that, then it's a perfect breeding ground for disease as well. So you can find in a lot of kind of wet areas we've got two small depressions on our chipping surround just now that have lay in a puddle because of the water table all winter. And if I cut that open with a knife and smell it, you can smell it's properly, it stinks, you know, it's rotten. But these bits will be like a sponge, you know, it's like a coral sponge. You can imagine in the summer when it dries out, it turns hydrophobic like a coral sponge. If you dry out in the bath and you pour water on it for the first time, it spills off. But then when it is wet, it stays wet. And it needs managed, you know.
So, hydrophobic there. So no, I am. I'm just making sure that we. So hydrophobic, you're saying that two parts of that. Number one, it's been sitting wet, so it's created this sort of rotting environment, which is no good for the parts where it's wet. And then, what do you mean when you say it's then hydrophobic when it dries out?
So the definition, I guess, of hydrophobic would be scared of water, wouldn't it? You know, if you're give me an example of a phobia, Sam. Yeah.
Wow. Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia. Scared of arachnoids. Is that right? Is that what they're called? Arachnoids?
Yeah, I think most people call them spiders, but you can call them arachnoids.
Yeah. I'm going from now on. But yeah, it's basically when the plant or the soil gets to a point where it can no longer take water on, and it just bounces it off, and that's why we use wetting agents to try and break down that surface tension, which is exactly.
And then that allows the water to sort of absorb properly into the soil profile and you know reset that sort of that problem. Strip the waxy
layers off any soil, you know, and break down the tension and break down the barriers to let the water through. Exactly that.
Soap for grass.
Well, you did say earlier that you thought I was washing my hair with Revolution, which I don't. I kind of think my hair's full of vitality just now. I've got a beautiful sort of shine and condition to it. So I don't know if Revolution would do that. Other wetting agents are available. But it just shows you it's not just a simple way. We've talked about height, we've talked about thinning the sward out through verticutting, taking out kind of any fat leaves or any that might be like lying down, matted. You know, if you are never brushing your greens, if you're just cutting all the time or just rolling, you find that the grass starts to kind of line one way all the time. You get a nap, which you can start pulling it up with your hands, and the grass looks like it's short, but it's actually, it could be about 10, 15 mil, you know.
It's just laying down.
Yeah, so you've got to constantly groom it all the time, you know, thin out. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, so that's a big one as well. And with I've different times a year, we have our fastest greens really when it's dry and cold. You know, just now the greens looked a lot faster today than they've been for quite a while. And moisture is the key for that, you know, whether that be the moisture that you've got in your soil, we often talk about when we try and dry the greens down for the open, because that was the way we're going to get speed. And the way that you make golf courses difficult, fun, and just generally awesome is if they're fast and firm and dry. Yeah. You know, that's how it makes. If you've got a wet golf course,
Saturday of the Masters. Look at Saturday of the Masters this year. I imagine it's quite a lot easier to manage the moisture levels through your greens if you have a multi-million pound sub-air system underneath that can suck the moisture out of them if they do get a bit too wet, but not many people are going to have that. What I'd like to know, Bledge, is we're in our theoretical green that started as almost 50%, let's say in our imaginary green, it was almost 50% poa and 50% fescue on day one. And then unfortunately someone's come along and cut it at 2 mil for 2 years. And what are we predicting? The fescues almost it's all gone. Entirely disappeared.
It's not even there. No, it's completely gone. 2 years at that. Yeah. It's away in year one.
So it's gone. Okay, so we've messed it up, and we're left with 100% fescue or near enough. How do you then maintain that green? What are the inputs that are required to get a putting surface that people would accept?
So I mean, 9 times out of 10 here with every golf club in Britain, you're going to go with a poor green there, aren't you? I mean, there'll be the 10% of clubs that'll be like, right, we'll do a fescue conversion. We'll take it back to. I mean, I would try my hardest to try and get it back, you know, because I'm more used to managing fescue, and I believe it's the way forward. But yeah, that I mean, how many times have you played a poor golf course and it's been an amazing putting surface? I mean,
I think especially in America, I think that most of them probably are because they are cut so low, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they're stunning. Some of the best surfaces I've ever seen have been poor.
Well, Oakmont probably, which is renowned for the fastest greens in the West, get up to about 18 on the stimp meter, I think, in September, October time. Crazy. Separate debate on whether that's ever fun for any kind of golfer ever, but we'll leave that debate for another day. But they surely the heights that they're going to have to cut out, they would struggle to have anything but poa.
Exactly that, you know, I mean, well, you can creep and bent, obviously, is the other go-to one. It loves being cut low, but again, very high maintenance grass. I mean, all these, this is what we're talking about, sustainability, creep and bent, poa, they take a lot of work, you know. They take a lot of top dressing, a lot of verticut, and a lot of hollow core, and a lot of water, a lot of nitrogen, you know.
So this is my question, because my understanding, Bledge, and I'd love you to sort of put a bit of detail in my layman's sort of summary here, but am I right in thinking if you've got a green that's cut really short, that probably gives you a very, very quick, slick playing surface for a portion of the year over the summer, but then, you know, we've all played places, particularly inland, where, you know, the greens, everyone will go, oh, they're the best greens I've ever putted on in August, and then you go there in November or March and your ball plugs and it almost gets sucked into the green and it doesn't come out of its pitch mark, and it's so soft and you can feel it moving about underfoot. Why would that sort of thing that I've just described there be recognizable to a lot of listeners? What is it about, you've got your poa green, you've cut it very short, what is it about, you know, do you have to water it more, put more fertilizer in, and then it grows more, and then it's, you know, do you end up in this almost like a vicious cycle of creating more nutrient?
Well, it's exactly the reason for when you're cutting it so short and it's losing a lot of its leaf blade, then it can't produce the energy that it needs to survive, so then you've got to supplement that with more water, more nitrogen. But you would find that most, well, I'm not sure that, like, the greenkeepers that cut 2.5 mil or 3 mil or whatever, they do that all the way through the winter. You know, you'll be raising heights up. All these guys will be raising heights up and just kind of taking their medicine in the winter. Sorry. Yeah, taking their medicine in the winter and just get back up to 5 mil or whatever. I mean, we were 5.5, 6 mil all the way through the winter there, and the greens weren't fast, but they were healthy. You know, I had to kind of think about the fact that it's peeing down every single day. The grass plant's stressed. We had a bit of disease in November. There's no way I'm going to be keeping it at 4 mil all the way through the winter. Not a chance. And you know, anyone that's kind of half sensible is not looking for 10 feet all the way through the winter, and especially not in the kind of composition we've got here. We've got Fescue Bent and a bit of Poa. You go to Castle Stewart. It's closed. King's Barns, Castle Stewart. So Castle Stewart's a better example because we've got pure Fescue greens up there. Some of the best greens I've ever putted on. But rested in the winter because, I mean, it just wouldn't be able to take the winter traffic. You know, pure Fescue golf course would just, it would come to spring, April, open it up for big paying American visitors, and it's just substandard because it's just been hammered by winter traffic. So, I mean, as we're going back to earlier, the talking about the Fescue Poa mix is probably the worst mix because you've got the finest grass leaf against a fatter, shorter grass leaf with a big seed head from this time of year till about July, I think. So
the difference when they grow through is a bit more noticeable. It sticks out a bit more.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's like chalk and cheese, you know. Whereas I've always called Bent and Fescue cheese and onion, but because it goes well together. But like Poa and Fescue is the worst combination. It really is.
Yeah.
And the biggest kind of risk when we always talked about spraying Rescue, which, so for the layman, the Rescue is a chemical that kills Yorkshire Fog and ryegrass and Fescue greens, and it doesn't touch the Poa and the Bent. But the first thing that's going to try and come into these gaps when you start to kill off is Poa, because it's opportunistic and it spreads, and it spreads to its flower, obviously. And the seedbed has obviously been there for hundreds of years. So when you're growing in these greens, after spraying this chemical, you need to be awesome at getting them going, you know, using good amount of fertilizer.
This is the next sort of question that I had on it. So we've identified the different types of grasses that we can have. We've identified that.
Can we talk about one more grass just before we go?
By all means.
Very important. So dwarf rye. So we've been talking about rye grass, but it's very, very unfair to put perennial rye grass, fat Italian kind of farmer's rye grass up there with dwarf rye. The rye grass that we used to have in some patches at Deal was the fat stuff, you know, but cut down at 4 mil, it was manageable, it was fine, you know. It was bad during strong growth types of year, where like August, when it just would not get cut with a cylinder mower, and you would have white patches in the greens where it would be like, the best way I could explain, if I was to cut your skin with a sharp knife, it would heal faster. If I was to cut it with a rugged one, it would probably get diseased. I mean, the tips of these rye, because you couldn't cut them because they're so strong. Even with the sharpest, straight out of the workshop cylinder mower, it would still like that. Like
really, white. It would almost blunt the thing over time.
You would look through a microscope on it, and you would see how all the hairs from the end of the blade, white hairs, you know, from the fact that it couldn't get a clean cut on it. And we used to get kind of white patches in the greens because of that, because this rye grass is so old and so strong. But if we're talking, when we're talking about dwarf rye grass, it's been a rye grass. It's been genetically, should I say? I can't say genetically modified or bred by other grasses to make from this, our seed growers to make this dwarf, which is basically, actually, a lot of the times does look like a darker Fescue, and they have modified them so much now that some of the more modern cultivars are so light in color and so fine that you can hardly tell the difference. And so much so, I mean, I have been blasted by a few keyboard warriors in the past in my time at Deal for putting dwarf ryegrass into some areas of the golf course, from walk-offs, from greens to tees, and through par 3 tees that get hammered and get loads of play. And I'm so glad I did. And I would do it all day long. Christ, they do it at St Andrews. They do it in walk-off here at St Andrews. And I've actually sewn it round the collar of our Hoy Lake putting green where everyone walks on. Everyone steps onto this beautiful Fescue putting green, but then it's just getting worn. So I cannot get Fescue Bent to grow in these areas without hammering it with fertiliser. So what do you do?
So that's
a bit of dwarf.
That would be sort of a weapon in your arsenal, almost, that allows you, it's something that has the look, the appearance, almost at times, maybe not completely the playability, but you're not putting them on playing areas per se. You're putting them on trafficked areas and walkways more often, but they have a bit more resilience and a bit more, they're a bit hardier, so they are more likely to stand up to the actual stress of people walking on them constantly, and it's almost like taking those two different characteristics. Is that how you'd character, an oversimplification, I'm sure, but is that sort of how you'd loosely characterize it, Bledge?
Yeah, definitely. And I know Graham Roberts will be listening to this. Graham has got an ultra fine dwarf ryegrass putting green, or a bit of it. I'm pretty sure it's the whole thing, because it could never, because of the subsoil in it and where it was near the clubhouse, I'm pretty sure they could never ever get any grass to grow in it. So Greg Easton grew this a dwarf rye putting green, and I'm pretty sure it's absolutely awesome. I don't think they have any problems. I think cut it 4 mil, it creates a fast, smooth playing surface. And why wouldn't you look at these golf courses in Scandinavia? They lose all their greens every year because of winter kill. They come into the winter, the golfers have got May, June, July, August, September to play golf, 5-6 months at most. Maybe the way weather patterns are shifting, they might get 6-7 actually into November if they're lucky. Why would you not get them playing golf as fast as possible by using this tool to get the greens in play faster? Let's not be snobs, can I say. And I'm sure you have a lot of people who will be listening to this that will agree, and you might have some traditionalists and purists, which I kind of, to be honest, I kind of see myself as that. I'm quite a purist when it comes to greenkeeping. I believe in purist values, but with the exception of ryegrass, I think I'm a realist in ryegrass for me. I've always flown the flag for ultra fine ryegrasses. I think they're the best, and me and Mr. Beggs share the same opinion on that, and it's worked a treat everywhere I've been.
Okay, well, let's just go back to our example, because I think the next point is one which you mentioned Ali Beggs there. I remember years ago, this was something you said to me that stuck with me. And what he said is a loss, you know, Sam, you've got to remember, most people think about greenkeeping as growing grass, and actually it's the exact opposite. You know, the whole art of greenkeeping and agronomy is stopping grass from growing, or more specifically, perhaps the types of grasses. Mm-hmm. And hopefully over the course of this podcast, put in people's minds the range of grasses that people do tend to see, making sure it is the grasses that you want to grow and stopping the grasses that you don't want to grow. So let's just imagine, Bledge, that we've got our 50-50, 100%, you know, poa and fescue green, and because our greens chairman has, against our advice, suggested that you cut it really short, and we have transitioned purely to almost entirely poa. But a few years have passed. The enrichment cycle has meant we've got a really, really rich organic thatchy layer below, and you want to transition that into, you want to get rid of all the poa and you want it to be fescue. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you can't just put a chemical down that kills all the poa and put a load of fescue seed down and wait a few months and expect for that to have worked. Is that the case? What would you have to do to change something properly over time?
This is the single worst scenario, because we're going to try and encourage a grass that has the exact opposite of what the other grass is thriving in. So there's two ways to do this, okay? It depends how much money you've got. I would probably just dig the greens up and start again, and I would have them.
Really, it's as bad as that. You've got to.
I would.
It's a hard reset.
Definitely, because, well, you're, for a start, you have to lift the greens, dig out your seed bed, because it's not just a case of just taking the turf off the top. Or, I mean, like, you could get a grade in, put a grade in over the top of them, you know, which is basically like a big wood plane that strips the top couple of inches, you know. So you're
so how far down have you got to take off then?
Do you know what? I would love to say that I knew exactly how far down the seedbed goes. I would have thought it would be a good couple of inches, but someone might on here, especially tough growers, if they listen or whatever, they might be able to correct me on that because I'm not sure. I don't know everything when it comes to that, but I don't know everything when it comes to anything, but I have a good stab at it. But you would be stripping that off, digging a bit out, and bringing some new root zone in and turfing them would be the fastest way to reset your greens and then managing them properly after that. If you're going the other way and the greens chairman's turned around and said, no, I want to do it with proper cultural practices, then you're going to have a lot of peed off golfers for a long time, because the first thing you're going to have to do is obviously raise your cutting heights. That poa is going to have to be starved out. It's going to have to be dried out. I mean, poa, what does it love? It loves water and nutrition. The two things
you're going to put it on a diet
quite as much as. Yeah, exactly. But then if you're growing new fescue in, what do you need? You need bloody water and nutrition. So it's an absolute nightmare of a scenario. I would love to hear from, if anyone's listening to this that has done a full poor conversion to fescue, because it's definitely would be the hardest one that you could ever do. But for me, I'd be pushing the old greens chairman for some cash to dig these mothers up, because years of pain in that.
Would it be an unfair oversimplification, Bledge, to say then that the more important element is not the seed that you're putting down, but the environment, the growing environment, the soil profile that you create, and you know, you put a lot of sand down as dressings, and I'm sure that, you know, if the whole purpose of this conversation is for, you know, golfers who play golf but never really thought about these things in any detail before, they might wonder why you're putting sand and more sand down, not just on the putting surfaces but also on our fairways as well, but you know, let's keep it just to the putting surfaces. What's the idea there with getting more sand actually into the greens?
You're creating the ideal opportunity or a host for the fescue and the bents, the desirable grasses to thrive in. But also from a playability point of view, top surface drainage, smoothness. But from a grass side, I mean, we're looking at kind of diluting that organic matter, keeping it. We really try for between like 3-4%. It's the absolute ideal. But we're kind of just now after this winter, we had them tested and we're kind of up about the 5. So we've got a bit of work to do with that. But still, it's still decent. Still decent. But yeah, sand for me is absolute key for this. And fescue loves sand, as we know, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's interesting. And the one other thing that I'd like to, because we started this by talking about green speeds, and I have a little pet peeve that if you surveyed 100 normal golfers, and none of us listening to this podcast are normal golfers, but if you asked 100 normal golfers what's a stimp meter, I think that probably a good chunk of them
meter probably is to start off with,
but I think probably a lot of them will give it a good stab as saying, you know they'll say, oh, my course where I play is 11 on the stimp, or stimps at 11, or stimps at 12, or they'll know that to their mind 12 might be good and 8 might be bad, and hopefully we have, you know, made the case for a little bit of restraint when it comes to speed, because the whole point of this conversation, I think, is if you're not careful by chasing speed solely, you can end up going down a path that's very hard to come back from and mm-hmm. ruin the sort of the makeup of the greens. But the other metric of arbitrary sort of metric of a greens performance that, to my mind, I wish people cared about but they never do, would be firmness. And you mentioned, Bledge, it's more enjoyable. Well, I would say, with my course architecture hat on, that firmness is really the most important thing when it comes to good design. The number one thing, full stop. And the reason I think that, way more so than speed. If you gave me greens that on the Clegg hammer were 140, and I'll ask you to explain that in a minute, but if you gave me greens that clegged at 140 and rolled at 9 on the stimp meter, well, that's a golf course that can be incredibly engaging, incredibly difficult for the best players in the world. And it doesn't have to be 14 on the stimp for it to offer up that challenge, because it seems like in order to get to 14 on the stimp, by and large, unless you are maybe Augusta National or a couple of other places with humongous budgets, in by striving to get to 14 on the stimp, you are never ever going to be able to get the firmness, because the types of grasses and the inputs that are required to maintain them are only ever going to lead to a wetter, softer profile with a type of grass on it that is woodier and thicker and will absorb the energy of a ball as it lands, rather than, let's say, you have a beautifully clean sand layer with fescue on top that the ball comes in and it's got 3% moisture and it just bounces off. Well, the reason why I say that that is, to my mind at least, so important is you've got to be coming into the greens, and if you're tucking a pin behind a bunker, you have got to be coming into it from the right position. And therefore, that influences not just the quality of the golfer's approach shot, but it also influences their drive so that they are able to get into position off the tee, which means that you can influence how good players will attack a hole, not just by how many fairway bunkers you've got up on there, not by growing the rough in, not by making the holes narrower, not even by making the holes longer, but you have been able to challenge the drive off the tee purely by where that pin sits in relation to the bunkers and the runoffs and the things that protect it. And the one thing that allows that to happen is firmness. So my final question is, what is that measure of firmness we're talking about? What is the Clegg hammer or other ways of quantifying it? And how does that impact the types of grasses that sit on the green? And how do you look to, again, make that the green profile as firm as possible?
So a Clegg hammer, for the layman, is a device that was used by road workers to test how firm the tar was, as I'm led to believe. It's called a it's got a decelerometer in it, which is like a plumb bob, like a metal weight, I guess, that is dropped from a specific height onto a surface, and it measures the speed at which it's decelerated in gravities. And to kind of let you know, like Parkland Green in the winter could be, when it's soft, could be around 70 gravities, 60, 70 gravities. The Open at St Andrews broke records when it was up at 140, 150. And the Open we had here, we were between, I think our lowest readings were like 110 and our highest were like 125, which it just was wet. So that's all you could get. But it's data testing. John Mark next door does his greens every single day, so he can monitor how they are during weather spells and if he needs to decrease his water or increase it or add rolling to it. I mean, there's many, many ways that affect firmness, you know, moisture being the most important one. I believe that during the Open we got good firmness because we had good hand mowers with the good heavy Toro electric flexes on them, which gave them a proper good roll and pushed that top surface and increased the and frequency of rolling and cut.
So it's as well compacting that top.
Exactly, yeah. Without compacting any sand underneath, because sand isn't really compact, but you could cut these greens all day, you know, and it certainly helps. But I mean, so we talk about moisture. I mean, growth, obviously, if you've got lush growth, it's if the greens are growing hard, and then that's going to be softer as well. But these are the main, but I'm a complete agreeance with you when it comes to firmness. I'm kind of obsessed with it as well. I remember when I first started here, I had a course walk with Craig before I started, and he had his thumb taped up to his finger, if I remember. Do you remember this?
And I remember that.
He says, because he used to always get down in the greens and push it with his thumb to see how firm it was, and he tripped and broke his finger. He'd compressed his finger in the green. Well, if he broke his finger in the green, they must have been firm enough. But yeah, I think we're all course managers are all obsessed with firmness, you know, because it's what makes links golf courses special. And as you say, it's what brings out the design features that they're meant to be shown.
But the great part of that is, whilst it makes it so much harder for the really, really good players, it actually often makes it easier for the average players. And that really is the hallmark of good golf course architecture. You know, if you've got firm fairways and firm approaches and firm greens in general, but if you've got firmness across a golf course, well, the Scotty Scheffler and Bryson, who are carrying it whatever 300 plus yards through the air, their balls when they land are bouncing out of position. The guy who carries it 200 yards on his best number, well, he might get 50 yards of run further down the fairway. Well, he's laughing, isn't he? Because it's made it harder for the guys who are now bouncing out of position, and easier for the guys that are getting an extra 50 yards of run on their shot, and same on their approach. And yes, you will probably have more long putts and chips, and your ball might land in the middle of the green and bounce through, but you know, you are more likely to be able to get a collection of pars and bogeys doing that as an average player. And the person who'll be most frustrated is the person who's looking for birdies and pars. But I thought we'll wrap it up now, Bledge, but I remember reading, it was a long time ago, so I've probably got these numbers wrong, and someone can furiously write in and correct us. But I would be interested in a bit of comparison, because if a relatively soft, especially after the amount of rain we've had, winter park then might be at, what did you say, 80 on the stimps?
I would say less.
Well, mm-hmm. I think Ali Beggs told me that he got his clay camera out at Royal Melbourne once, and I think it was 195. Was the number that he got. And we should get, perhaps we should get my colleague Mike Clayton on the pod to talk about that sand structure and the firmness that they're able to get, because that is an absolute hallmark of the Melbourne sandbells, isn't it? And I think
sand
the other
shape,
one,
isn't it, you know,
the way it locks together, the way they get those bunkers with the such sharp edges without the sand collapsing.
Yeah. You can literally bounce a golf ball on them.
Yeah, and they take their trolleys onto the greens, don't they? And they, you know, it almost, that firmness defines the golfing culture that they have. It's so important, but also so unique. But I think the other one I remember reading, which I found interesting, was in cricket. Did someone, have you ever seen that, Bledge? I think at Lords, the wicket at Lords is something like 400 gravities. Did you ever get that?
Yeah, I didn't know that. But I mean, I know they use clay cameras a lot in cricket, and there you're drying out that surface. They put sheets over it, obviously, to dry out, don't they? And use penetrant wetting agents, I think, so. Yeah, that's the absolute key.
People can write in and I think.
Can I just one more thing? It's really important.
Of course.
So I think one thing we didn't touch on that's massively, massively important, and I'll be very, very brief on it, but is how you set your machines up when it comes to speed as well. You know, it's not all just down to chucking sand, fertilizer, and water, or not chucking it out. But when it comes to your machinery set up, whether it be your cylinders, your blades, or the kind of angles you have, everything, and quality of cut is a big, big influence, and it cannot be underestimated enough, really, when it comes to that. So having a good mechanic that knows his stuff for that.
I was going to ask that, because I was thinking earlier, Bledge, when I was trying to equate grass as a plant, as a living thing, rather than just, you know, a carpet, as people might think of it as, and disease. And you were saying about, you know, if you cut your skin and you've got a rusty old blunt razor that you've given yourself a cut with, what's that, how's that likely to heal? What's it going to do disease-wise, susceptibility? Or conversely, if you've got a super sharp scalpel and you just give a little cut there and it's really clean cut, do you think it's a fair sort of comparison in people's minds to, rather than think of grass as just one part of a contiguous surface, to instead think of it as a proper little plant, a proper little organism that if you cut it short, it's not going to have the energy. If it's wet, it's more likely to get a, you know, almost get a cold, really. It's almost just get a bit more disease susceptibility. And if you don't cut it with a clean blade, it's more likely to feel a bit under the weather. And all of those things make you almost think of it as just standalone, this living organism, rather than just part of a surface.
Any greenkeeper that's into their job and that thinks like maybe a bit mental like I do, and maybe the business makes you like this, but I speak to my greens. You know, they are. Come on, guys, they are living things, you know, and the dunes are and everything, you know. And if you treat them like crap, then they'll get sick, you know. And as I was kind of explaining, we've kind of felt I had really healthy greens going into November, and we got a bit of disease, you know, and I just kind of explained like even Mo Farah probably gets a cold every now and then, doesn't he? You know, I mean, you probably got a very healthy diet and exercise, but definitely. I mean, you need to treat your golf course well, and by using the proper machinery on it, is doing that, you know, and it's essentially getting to cut your grass as high as possible and giving the golfers the most optimum surface, you know, without having to shave things down. And I mean,
yes,
in a world where we're getting less and less chemicals, and I mean, Christ, fertilizers are hard to get a hold of as well now at times, and we've got, who knows what's going to kick off in Israel, where we get a lot of raw materials from, and Russia.
Water availability, sand availability, going for all of these things are coming for us, and I think we should do a separate episode on that, Bledge. So perhaps if people have questions specifically about natural source of inputs, do you think, you know, sustainable inputs, what can you do if you were setting up a golf course to grow in a post chemical world, and you've almost got to go back to Jim Arthur and sustainable greenkeeping with minimum inputs possible. How can you give yourself a fighting chance of doing that?
By having members that are acceptant of change and what would be coming their way, because you ain't going to turn a light switch off and then just say, oh, we're going to go chemical free. There's going to be repercussions of that, and people are going to have to get you, if it does go down this route, they're going to have to get used to having weeds and disease in their greens for a while until we all master together the actual art of greenkeeping. So everyone's done it before us, you know.
I guess that takes us completely full circle and is a good place to finish then, Bledge. When we were talking at the start of the show about John Mack and his offer to help develop those communication skills, just as much as the actual turf management skills as well. Because you could, you know, if you're the best person in the world at managing surfaces, but you've got a membership there that are demanding that you cut it at a height that you know isn't going to work, and you know, demand as something that you know the budget of the club isn't going to permit, and you know that you're going to end up doing something that's setting yourself up for fail in the years to come. gosh, I can only imagine then that the value of being able to communicate, to educate the membership as to why you can't cut it 2 mil if you want to have fescue greens, you want to cut it whatever 5 mil or whatever, and why you need to put sand down, why you need to do all of the things that we've just talked about. I guess
they need to send them a link to the Golf Badgers podcast, don't they? Everyone, members need to listen to this episode, and then they'll start to.
Well, it's why I think this is. It's why I think this is important, because the more people that think about it a little deeper, the better, because we need an army of people out there. When someone says, "Oh, the greens were too slow," we need the greenkeeper to go and chop them down next week before the medal. We need someone in the spike bar, wherever it is, to go, "Well, actually, there's a bit more to it than that," because the more people start having those conversations, hopefully, the better it can be for educating memberships as a whole, and giving you guys, all the course managers out there who are presenting courses, give you a fighting chance of doing something that this is actually doable.
Good. Well, we hope that you've all enjoyed this episode, and less not as much greenkeepers, because they know all this stuff, all these guys, but the more kind of member listenership and golfers and such like, friends, etc., and probably my mother. So I'm going to give a shout out as well to my mother in this episode. This is
Scottish Jenny Blige.
Hi.
Brilliant. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Thank you, Blege, and look forward to the next episode.
Good. Excellent. Night, night, Badgers.